program is before you. We are going to deal with the process for filling vacancies at the South African Human Rights Commission, and secondly, with the responses by the Department of Justice on the Protector's Disclosures Bill. So we start with the process for the filling of vacancies. Let me say, by way of opening, that we have a challenge here. The challenge is that we only received the mandate from the House to deal with this matter now in August, because we were all, the House was in recess because of the local government elections, and that means that the time available to process this issue, it's limited. So we are going to work under a very tight schedule, and I hope that all members will commit and make themselves available when required on the dates that are going to be proposed here, because we want to make sure that there is more than adequate public participation in the process. We want to make sure that the public as a whole is given sufficient time to comments and objects, and we also want to make sure that the public comments and objections are given full attention by ourselves, so that the product that we produce is a product that is co-owned by ourselves and the public, because we are not appointing these commissioners for ourselves as political parties. We are appointing these commissioners for South Africa and her people. So every opinion, objection by members of the public is going to be fully considered and taken into account in the process. We have proposed program that we are going to table, and with the permission of the House, I will propose those dates, and then we can engage and see if we are all happy, and where we are not happy, you have the fullest opportunity to raise, and not only object, but also propose the alternative to what is before you. Do you all have this draft program? If you have, you will see that our proposal is that the 22nd to the 30th September is period for public comments, which means that the list of applicants that I want to assume has been distributed. Do you all have it? The list of the names? That list will be released for public comments and will also be put on the Parliament website, so that all interested parties can access it And then on the 5th of October, in fact, I must say that there was some information, I don't know from where, that we were meeting today to shortlist. We are not shortlisting anything. As I said, we are releasing the names and putting those names on Parliament website for public comments and objections. And that time is between today and the 30th of September. And then on the 5th of October, we will do the shortlisting of candidates. And the shortlist will also be released and be put on public or on Parliament website, so that I'm repeating for those whose attention was stolen that the shortlist will also be put on public website, website on the Parliament website, will also be released for further comments and objections. And only on the 13th of October, when we have received those public comments and objections and fully considered them, then will we go and do the interviews on the 13th of October 2016. And on the 19th of October 2016, then we will deliberate on the outcome of those interviews. And on the 25th October 2016, then we will hold further deliberations and finalize the recommendations to Parliament. I must say, honorable members, that this tight time frame was imposed on us by the fact that we only received our mandate on the in August, after coming back from recess. So we have been left with a little choice. We would actually have loved to give the public much more time for participation, for comments and objections. But in the circumstances, this is the best that we can do. And we believe that this will be adequate for all interested members of the public to comment. Honorable members, Honorable Sart, Honorable Hon.
Jay, I think this is initially a good program. I just wanted to find out what exactly happened with the last process where we shortlisted the names and it went to the House. Because whatever blame must be attributed, I'm not sure where it lies, because we in fact received on the 1st of April last year the first instruction to fill a nomination. Then on the 21st of October we received a second letter, and that process, I remember, was delayed here because we then decided there were two vacancies, remember. So then the beginning of this year, we conducted a process of shortlisting. We submitted two names to the House. Those names were, we never heard anything further. So maybe you could advise us, if you are aware, what actually happened with that process. I just want to find out, because obviously we now are under pressure. We seem to have done our process from the committee side, where we submitted names. those two names. That's the first issue, but that's historical. We don't have to spend a lot of time on that. I think we are, you correctly say, we've now got a mandate from August to fill the following vacancies. But I noticed now that there are going to be a number of further vacancies from the 30th of September. Are we anticipating filling those vacancies as well? So are we, well, maybe we can just get clarity as to how many we need to fill. Then the second issue is the list of names. There are 80 names here. Have we done the homework to ensure that all those 80 people qualify to stand? That's the first step we need to do before we advertise those names for public comment. And that maybe the researchers can do, because there would probably be members there or nominees that don't qualify at all. I'm very pleased that we are inviting public comment on it, like we did on the ad hoc committee of the public protector. There was a lot of public interest around it, and I think that I'm grateful that we are following the same process. I just also wanted to find out the fact that we're going to be dealing with our BBR processes as well in this time. Has that been also put into the process, because they're very tight deadlines as to our BBR report that has to be in that same time almost. So I'm sure you've considered all these issues, but I'd just like for my information. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I think in conjunction with the questions raised by the Honourable Swart regarding the number of vacancies to be filled, I think that would obviously inform also the number of candidates to be interviewed. And at this stage, if my calculations are correct, we actually have 7 positions to fill. And then if we are to shortlist enough people, I think at the point where we must say to each other that one day for the interviews cannot be sufficient. One of the weaknesses of the public protector process was the fact that we not only expected of the committee members, but also of some candidates to be available between 2 and 3 in the morning after they've been sequestered at 7 already the previous day. And we cannot allow a situation like that to develop here. So I think we must have a discussion on how many people we will ultimately interview. If we must appoint 7 people, I don't know whether, I see we will be advised by the content advisors, I don't know whether there is at this stage an indication from either them or the commission as to what the areas of expertise or focus is of those who will be vacating office and have vacated office, because that obviously must also inform the shortlisting and the interviews. So whilst I'm broadly in agreement that yes, it's good that we have the public participation and we are aware of the tight timelines which was caused for whatever reasons, I think there's other discussions we must have first before we can adopt this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just wanted to talk to the numbers of commissioners that we've actually been mandated to advertise for positions for. It is 7. I think one other thing that is important, because I think some of the members were not available in the previous meetings to make the minutes available. But I think it's 7. But what we could do is to ask the committee researcher just to take us through what is the provision of the law in terms of the numbers. Because by end of October, we will be left with one commissioner, Commissioner Amemia. So we will be advertising for the entire complement of the commissioners. And I think with the new legislation, the numbers of commissioners have been added. But can we get maybe Christine to just guide us on this?
I think there are other questions which were raised that needs to be dealt with before we get to the legal requirements. The first one was what happened to the two names that we had appointed. You want to address that?
I thought maybe by saying that we need to just help the members by also making the minutes available so that we could actually be accurate in terms of the response, the minutes of the meeting, because the committee did have a consensus on that matter.
Mr. Swart is happy with your response. There was also his question whether the 8 members, all 8 names are going to be released.
80,
yeah. And whether it would be right to release those names before some kind of screening. To the best of my knowledge, that screening is the responsibility of Parliament, not of ourselves. But given the time limitations that we have, we cannot allow another process by Parliament because it's going to affect our program. So would the members agree that we release all these names? Because I guess everybody who has applied are by implication accepting that they are subjecting themselves to public scrutiny. You can look for a public position without submitting yourself to public scrutiny. Would anyone have a problem if we say the 80 names are going to be released as such and also be put on the public Parliament website? I think those who don't object must say it loudly for the record. Honorable Swart?
That's fine, Chair. That's fine.
Honorable Majake? You agree?
No objection, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. The other issue was whether this would not interfere with the BBR process. In developing this program, we took into account that fact, and we hope that we'll be able to deal with both without any challenges. And then the third issue was the number of people that will be interviewed, and secondly, the view or objection to using one day. Can we hear members firstly on the number of, or that will come from, okay, Honorable Majaki.
I think we need to deliberate on that. Maybe the committee must decide on how many names we will want to have for the 7 positions, and then we can look at the amount of time we're going to be giving each candidate, and then look at the duration thereafter, as to whether we need a day or two. And my suggestion would be maybe three candidates per vacant position. So which means if we've got 7, then we could have 21 candidates to interview.
I think that's a very good approach, Honorable Majake, that make a proposal, and those who don't agree must come with a counter-proposal so that we find a solution. Honorable Bredenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose that we limit the number of people we interview to 15. That's 2 per position plus 1 extra. We can take the 15 best people. There's no need to trawl through 3 per position. We can only appoint 7 people.
Actually, every proposal must go with the motivation so that we don't just come with arbitrary figures and because we have to justify to the public and to the people of South Africa why we are doing certain things. Honorable Horn and Honorable Mpumlwana.
Yeah, Chair, the way I've looked through the CVs, and that's why I say I think we also need advice as to the areas of focus or specialization that's needed amongst those to be appointed. For example, it would make perfect sense if we say that we need somebody uniquely suited to look after the interests or the rights of those people with disabilities, to then shortlist three applicants who we feel of fitting that bill. But in other respects, I think it's a more general type of applicant you are looking for who can later develop certain areas of focus or special skills within the commission. And then I agree with the Honourable Breitenbach that if there's no specific already identified focus area for each of the seven, you don't necessarily need to say 3 times 7. So I'm again back at the point to say that I think we must be properly briefed as to what is expected of these different commissioners. Within the commission, is there certain set roles and functions for certain commissioners, or do they do the arrangement themselves, that type of thing? Thank you.
If I understand you well, before we even say 15 or 21, we need this briefing, and the person who is to brief us is running away. But in the meantime, let me say that the law is there to guide us, but also we have to look at four things. Among this is the experience of the candidate, the special skills that the candidate is bringing, and there's also whether the person is a fit and proper person. Honorable Swart.
Chair, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think that you're making very good comments about the experience of persons. And I think it's very important, because there's so many vacancies, that we need to bear in mind that people can be reappointed if they've reapplied. And there needs a degree of continuity as well. Otherwise, you're going to have 7 new commissioners coming in. So I think that added to your comment about experience is the fact that, as I understand it, that a commissioner can be reappointed for a second term. And that we need to consider that as a very important criteria because of continuity. Otherwise, I think there's one remaining commissioner. So you need that continuity as well, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Short, for that intervention. So we are saying that we will look at experience, we'll look at the special skills, we'll look at the integrity of the person, whether the person is fit and proper, and secondly, the eligibility of the current commissioners. What Honorable Swart refers to as continuity and reappointment. So those would be the criteria that we are going to use. So when we talk about reducing the number to 21 or to 15, it means we must be guided by this criteria, so that we do not arbitrarily eliminate people so that we are able to do the work within a short time. So there is nothing that is about our convenience. Honorable
Chairperson, Honorable Swart, was it Honorable Swart or Honorable Horn, mentioned disability. Can you also add gender? That we will consider gender balance.
Gender and disability. So we have two additional criteria. Honorable Mpumlwana?
I thought,
First
of all, I just wanted to say you mentioned the fifth, and here is written the sixth. I don't know whether my ears could hear properly.
No, that when I said the fifth, I was correcting that, because it's not the sixth, it's the fifth.
Oh, it's the fifth?
Yes.
So, secondly, I thought that because of the number that is there, which is about 80, and I think that without having looked at all the CVs, I think 21 will be fine for now.
Honorable Mutapu.
Thank you, Chairperson. On issue of criteria, there is also an issue of geographic spread, which we need to take into consideration. Yes. And again, I want to respond to issue relating to ad hoc committee on public protector as...
Before you move, I hope we all agree that geographical spread is a very important issue, because we also have the language question, and we have 9 provinces. We don't want people who will only be able to speak English. We want people who can speak other languages and who understand other cultures, because we are not dealing with objects but human beings.
On the issue of duration, number of days on which we can conduct our interviews, I think we need to look into several things. Issue of fairness and issue of other people. If we say more than one day, are the people who are going to come on the subsequent day not going to have an added advantage? So the previous committee, ad hoc committee, did very well in that regard. Everybody was happy. So to come here and say, no, it wasn't fair. No, as politicians,
honorable members, I don't want to see a hand when a member is on the floor. Yes, please.
I'm just putting this question for us to take into consideration. Issue of fairness and others going to have an added advantage of having watched those who came earlier on and anticipating questions, saying, oh, I know Honorable Mutapu is going to ask fit and proper in this sense. I know how to respond. So we need to take that into consideration, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honorable Breedenbach, even if you had not raised your hands, I will give you space, because you raised this issue, and we are interested in your...
Thank
you. And insight on the matter.
I hear what the Honorable Mutapu says. I cannot agree with her less, however. The public protector interviews were farcical in the way that they were conducted over one long day. Thank you. The candidates are all adults, as are all the persons on the committee. They were locked in a room in the public protector interviews where they had access to smartphones and tablets and laptops. And if they had so desired, they could have live streamed the interviews of everybody else. Everybody's CV is different. The interviews cannot be the same. Everybody's CV is different. Every person gets interviewed on their own merits. There's no possibility of anticipating. So it really makes absolutely no sense to lock 15 or 21 or 90 adults in a room for an entire day and interview people till 3 o'clock in the morning, when the object of preventing them from watching it on television is obstructed by the fact that everybody has a smartphone, everybody has a laptop, everybody has a tablet, and if they wanted to, they could watch it to their heart's content. It's really just not in consideration.
I will allow, recognize people who have raised their hands. Honorable Breitenbach, the ad hoc committee on the public protector, of which you are part, has been hailed as having done a very good job. And the parliament itself approved that the report of that committee. So to say to us that their operations were
I didn't say that the interviews were farcical. I said the interviews being held on one day is farcical. I didn't say the entire process was farcical. Of course it wasn't. We all participated, and it was a very good process. It's completely and utterly unnecessary to have it on one day, and it is farcical to suggest that people can't watch it on phones, on laptops, on tablets, just because you keep them away from a television set. It's madness.
You don't have to be angry, just raise your, be cool, take a deep breath and raise your objections, and then we are debating. We are debating now. Honorable Majake and Honorable Short.
Just a request for clarity on people who are locked up in a room. Can they arrive at different times? They can arrive at different times. The ones that you see in the morning, you could actually allocate them, schedule their arrival around the particular time, and the ones that you know you're going to be seeing later could then be, because I don't understand why would everybody have to arrive the same time when you're not going to be interviewing these people at the same time. Something just doesn't feel right. But I wasn't part of the logistical arrangements of the public protector interviews, but naturally when you've got interviews, this is what happens. The candidates do not arrive at the same time.
No, it's really not about the public protector interviews. As Honorable Ntapo correctly said, we have to look at the fairness of the process. Now, when you answer Honorable Breedenbach, do that in the light of the numbers that you suggested, 15. She suggested, you suggested 21. She suggested 15. What would be wrong? Because if we apply the criteria already agreed to, and then we reduce the numbers to 15, not arbitrarily, based on the criteria. And then we said, because the number is then less, one day would suffice. What would be the problem? Can we debate that issue? Honorable...
The process with the public protector was a learning curve. And whilst we all agree it was an open and transparent process, at the end of the process and during the debate, most of us realized that it was unfair to do all the interviews on one day because the pressure it put on us doing the interviews as well as those people that had to wait the whole day. And so, Chair, if you compare, and it was a first time in my 17 years that we did all the interviews on one day, unless in other cases where there were very few interviews, like five, then we could do it in one day. But the rationale is not followed by the Judicial Services Commission or the Magistrates Commission, where the same degree of thinking a person hears the questions before would apply. So I think that the fairness, and obviously it depends on if we only decide on five or seven names, then you can do any one. But if we're now talking of 15 names, it must be over 2 days. It must be, because it's unfair. And we've got the precedent, because we need to guide Parliament as well. That process was a learning curve. It shouldn't set the precedent now, going forward. As we all said, it was a lengthy process, and the pros must outweigh the cons. I hear what Ms. Matopa says, that some people might have an advantage, but again, it is done in other constitutionally required, the Judicial Services Commission, Magistrates Commission, where you do interviews over many, many days. The Magistrates Commission, where you interview 30, 40 magistrates, the ones that come from the first will know the questions, and it's just the process because of the sheer number of people
and the fairness to them of hearing the questions. The other fairness that must be balanced against that is the fact that we as MPs, the later persons, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you are all exhausted. And do you give that person a fair interview? When you're tired, they're tired. And so I'm not in favor of the idea of people being locked away in a room. That is not respectful of these leaders of society as well that are coming and had to sit till 2-3 o'clock the next morning from 8 o'clock in the morning. If Ms. Polani Majaki indicates that people can come later, then you can have it over 2 days because then it defeats the object. They will then have access to watching the interviews or whatever the process is. I'm not sure if this process is going to be televised or what, but I think we need to bear in mind there are interviewing processes that are different to what was adopted by the ad hoc committee. It was an open, transparent measure, but it was a degree of experimenting as well with interviews on one day. And I think because of the large numbers of people, remember there we only had to appoint one person. Here we have to appoint 7 people. And to be fair, we're going to need a number of maybe 15 to 20 people being interviewed. And it can't be done over one day. I would suggest that we seriously consider the fact that we're going to have to do it over 2 days to be able to get the best 7 candidates. And so, Chair, that's my view. But from my side. Thank you, Chair.
Before I add other names, I think Honorable Swart is helping us to say that in addition to the fairness proposed by Honorable Mutapu, there is precedent. It's not the first time that this Parliament has got to interview people. We have had cases, the Judicial Service Commission, where we interview over a long period, Magistrates Commission. So let's take also those experiences into account. And he's also saying that, you know, the public protector interviews were a learning curve, so we cannot just follow everything like puppets and say because they interviewed in one day, we also necessarily have to interview in one day. But the debate is still open. Honorable Maila, and then Honorable Majake.
No, thanks, Chair. The other issue that I wanted us to look at is the issue of time allocation for each candidate, whether we are going to set time limits or it will just be an open thing, because if we don't set time limits, then it might be a problem. But if we have time, we can be able to debate and see whether a day or 2 days will be feasible.
I've been covered by Honorable Maila. I wanted to just indicate that we need to decide on the amount of time we'll provide each candidate as we decide as to the number of candidates and the amount of time we need for the entire interviews.
Looking at fairness to the candidates, what would we say is the time that we must allocate to the interviewer for each? Honorable Swart.
I would suggest 1 hour is probably sufficient. And again, one can possibly consider giving the interviewee an opportunity of 5 minutes to just introduce themselves and why they believe they are fit for this position. And then we have a question. Bear in mind that this committee is smaller, much smaller than the ad hoc committee, which was much larger, and there were far more MPs that wanted to put questions. So I think initially my thoughts are, obviously other MPs are welcome to join this committee and ask questions on that day, but all indications would be that it would be us that would be asking, the members of this committee. So I would suggest that we should look around at an hour in total. But it's not binding or set in concrete, but it's just to give guidance to the interview.
What is the rationale for other MPs joining and asking questions? Where does that come from?
No, Chair, it's purely those members that are interested that may attend this committee and as any other MPs are entitled to join. As happened with the ad hoc committee, there are other MPs that were interested in the process, whilst not formally appointed to the ad hoc committee, they joined the process and were duly entitled to ask questions.
Now, then if 50 so-called interested MPs can walk in, then they are all entitled.
They are.
So anyone can rent a crowd of MPs and bring them.
Have I given you an idea now, Chairperson?
I think we need order, because we are saying we will publish the names on Parliament website for the public. And even MPs who are not members of this committee qualify as members of the public. Why should we expand the committee contrary to the rules of Parliament for people who can have other avenues to participate? And as you correctly said, that committee was a learning curve. And it doesn't mean that everything that happened there must happen here unless we have a rationale for it. But anyway, let me leave that. Who was the next Honorable Honorable Mpumlwan and Honorable Mutapu?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. In respect of the time allocation, I just want to remind those of us who were involved with the interview process during April. I think then we allowed for less than an hour. And then after a few interviews, I think we didn't even use up the full time allocation for each of the candidates. In saying that, I don't want to say that we should not go for an hour, but we should also not place ourselves in a position where we sit idly for 15 minutes after every interview. So if we go for an hour, I think that must then include comfort breaks and whatever, to get yourself a cup of tea or whatever. That must be the absolute maximum. Otherwise,
You see, also, when you are interviewing a person, you don't want to be having comfort breaks and two breaks while the person is being interviewed. So let's look for the time that we think is reasonable and will be fair to the candidate. Honorable Mpumlwan?
I think if we give them 45 minutes each, maybe.
I want to comment on the time now.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think as a committee, we should be parliamentary enough. Utterances of words such as absolute nonsense are very much unparliamentary, Chairperson. Such as absolute nonsense. Those are very much unparliamentary. Honorable Breitenbach, he said that's absolute nonsense after I've raised issues. So I think, Chairperson, we are leaders of society. And societies are looking upon us as their mentors. But if we come here and utter such words and become so disrespectful, what are we teaching our grandkids, our kids, our communities? Okay, coming back to the issue, Chairperson.
Well, I'd like to say something too then. Oh, good. I suggest that the Honourable Mutapu grows a thicker skin, for starters, and stops assuming that everything is aimed at her personally.
I don't think we should really debate this matter. The bottom line is that we must not only show respect to one another here, but show respect to the public out there. So the choice of words is very important, because we are also dealing with the image of Parliament itself. We are not here in our personal capacity, we are here in the official capacity. So let's do those things that advance the image of Parliament and show respect to our people as a whole. Thank you very much. Proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. We learn a lot from some people. People portray their images. Thank you. Let me follow up on what Honorable Horn has just said. Emanating from our past interviews on those two candidates, I've learned that, Chairperson, we didn't take much time on each, although we allocated time, but we didn't spend that time on each and every candidate. So I will align myself with Honorable Mpumlana that we utilize plus minus 45 minutes on each and every candidate.
Mine is just a question because I don't think we finalized as to how many people are going to be interviewed.
No, actually, what I want to hear now, it's on the time, whether it's 45 minutes or 1 hour.
It's fine. Oh,
45 minutes. 45 minutes is agreed. And I want to agree that the 5 minutes could be the candidates to introduce themselves, and 40 minutes is enough time, especially that our criteria are clear. We know what we want from each candidate. Now, can we then go to the number of days? Honorable Laila, are you speaking on? I'm sorry, number of candidates.
I would agree with Honorable Majake that we stick to 21.
Okay, Honorable
Jay, I think that it might be helpful to have 15 or 21. If it's 21, then or 15, it should be over 2 days. But I think what can help us as well is the questionnaire that we can ask those shortlisted candidates to fill in, that we, a similar one that we had with the ad hoc committee on the public protector, which was specific as to why, and there were some specific questions which the one could adapt, and that questionnaire could also reduce the time of the interview. I think that, but because it's such a large number, I'm inclined to think 15 or 21, between that number, but we need to ensure that our short list has enough sufficient persons to fill those 7 figures. When we did the ad hoc committee, we shortlisted, and during some of the interviews, we found that 1 or 2 were clearly not suitable at all, with due respect to those persons. So the danger is that you need to be very careful who you shortlist then, because we are filling 7 vacancies, Chair.
Yes, Chair, in respect of the shortlisting and the number of days, I want to say the following, and maybe I can say it because I didn't attend the meeting of the Public Protector Ad Hoc Committee where the shortlisting was done. But in my view, Parliament and this committee can save itself a lot of trouble if we make a big effort about the shortlisting. So I'm careful in saying this, but I feel uncomfortable with the way shortlisting sometimes is done by way of us pitching to the meeting, and then names are just proposed and added, or in some instances, if there's only one member of the opposition, all of a sudden you need a seconder or something like that. If we agree as a committee that we will spend a full working day on the shortlisting, and we say we will limit the number of candidates to be interviewed to be no more than 20, we may even end up with less than 20. But be that as it may, if we agree that we spend 45 minutes on an interview and there's 21 interviewees, then it comes to roughly 16 hours of interviews. And then in answering your question as to how many days we must set aside, there is really, for all practical and reasonable purposes, no other way than doing it over 2 days. Thank you.
any other issue? I think we agree on the time.
45 minutes. And then there was the question of days. I'm actually personally persuaded, and I'm still open to persuasion, that 2 days should not harm us, because although also you don't want to interview people when you are tired or the other people are tired, then the whole issue of fairness then opens up. Is there anybody who still want to talk on that question of 1 or 2 days, given the motivation that we shouldn't interview exhausted people, and we also shouldn't interview people when we are sleepy ourselves, because it will affect the fairness of the process? Honorable Majaki.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I think Honorable Strauss' argument is convincing. We can go for 2 days.
Are we all happy? Honorable Majaki supports the proposal by Honorable Strauss.
Can I then suggest that we aim for 15, with 15 names with a maximum of 21, so we can play between those two numbers when we shortlist? So we accommodate both views here. We aim for 15, but if the need arises, we can go up to, say, 20, as Mr. Polani Majaki indicated.
I think in different ways, Honorable Horn dealt with that matter, because it's one thing to fix the number, and another thing, when you are looking at the names, you may find that you don't need 21, you need 15. So if you, as you correctly say, play between 15 and 21, that should cover us. Is there anyone who has a problem with that?
Chair, lastly, are we in agreement to request the questionnaire that they fill in as well before they do the final interviews? Because I think that was very helpful as well.
Yes, yes. I don't see anyone opposed to the questionnaire. And we have
a
precedent of a questionnaire that was done before. So there is no problem. Honorable, I'll come back to you. Honorable.
Who prepared the question? Does the questionnaire?
The secretariat. So no political intervention.
Okay, what about security vetting before we do the process?
No, we don't.
I'm only joking. I withdraw that, Jay. I was just joking.
No, but it's important that you raise it and then we take a position. My understanding is that what we need is a pre-screening by Parliament itself.
Yes.
Okay. So we'll do pre-screening. We'll provide a questionnaire, and the criteria have been agreed, and we say 15 to 21 candidates over 2 days.
Two consecutive days.
Yes, very good. Can I summarize what we've agreed? We have agreed that between today, the 22nd to the 30th of September, it will be a period of public comments. On the 5th of October, we will do shortlisting of the candidates. We have 80 candidates who will be pre-screened by Parliament, and we will put these 80 names on the, we are releasing today the 80 names, and we are also putting them on the Parliament website, and for the public to comment and object. And we are saying that the comments and objections of the public are of paramount important. We will consider them and take them into account in the shortlisting of the candidates. And that will ensure that the people that we interview on the 13th of October will be the product of this committee and the public at large, because we are not appointing these people for the committee and for parliament, but for the people of South Africa. We are saying that on the 19th, we will be holding our deliberations, but that our deliberations will be based on the following criteria: experience of the candidates, special skills, integrity, that is the fitness and properness of a person, and also that we will, the serving commissioners will be eligible for reappointment, so that a continuity principle is preserved. The other criteria would be gender, disability, and geographic spread. And then we are saying that the number of candidates to be interviewed will be between 15 and 21, depending on the pre-screening and the shortlisting processes. So we do not want to arbitrarily agree on a number. So our decision must be informed by reality. And then we are saying that on the 25th of October, then there will be deliberations and finalization of the process. And we have agreed as well that the interviews will be over 2 days, and that a questionnaire will be made available for people to complete, to ensure that we make quality decisions in the shortlisting of the candidate. And we are saying that paramount in this process is fairness to the candidates, all the candidates, and also transparency, and that public opinion, public objections will be fully taken into account in the whole process. Is there anything that I left out, my Honorable Ntumla?
No, I just wanted to request that when we talk about the public, we include the radios in the other African languages. Apart from most cases, you find that it's only NGOs and people who speak English are able to
extend some on smooth all the radio stasis Hebraic, on smooth all the Tala Hebraic and Slate and the Afrikaans and all the NHMZ Tala van South Africa, and ons gaan seker maak dat al die lid van hierdie komitee sal attack kry om in spesifieke tale te praat. So all of us are going to be nyaka o lebotsa gore le ka kilobedi gore tore batho bothe ba Afrika Tshipembe ba tshwanetse gore ba tle gore na re apaka eng taba e ba fithele. So we respect all our languages, and we are going to make sure that the information flows in all these languages, and members of this committee will be deployed to particular radio station with slots, and they will be given time as information. And if there's one thing that we should not do, is when you are assigned to a slot, and then we hear the broadcast saying that you are not available, because that would be disrespect to the public that we're supposed to communicate with. So, honorable members, any other thing? So from the secretariat, you'll have to work out a program of interviews with names. Honorable Horn?
Yeah, sorry, Chair. Just for planning purposes, the draft program says the shortlisting is on the 6th, but verbally you said the 5th. Can we just, for our diary purposes, have the...
Is the fifth. So, is the fifth. Christine?
Is there anything from with regard to what the law and the constitution is saying?
What we have not touched on, or should the Honourable Majority?
I think what you need to just clarify is, in terms of the 7 positions, how many should be full-time, how many should be part-time? Taking into consideration the one remaining position now.
Say among other things, that must be the thing, but we also want to be sure that all the legal loopholes are covered. Proceed.
Chair, I just need some guidance. Did you want to go through the full presentation that I prepared, or are you happy just to read through it?
We don't need the whole presentation.
You know, the,
talk to me.
The idea is that we don't want you to give you a lecture, but to say what we have agreed here. Does that is that covered by the law, or is there anything that we have said or agreed to that is outside the law? So talk to what you have in relation to our problem.
Everything that has been said is fine in terms of the law. There are a couple of additional things that I added. First, to talk about the full-time, part-time. From mid-October, there'll be one remaining commissioner, Commissioner Niemeyer. He's full-time, which means that we have to fill 5 full-time positions and 2 part-time positions. The other thing that the committee needs to think about when we do our interviews is that the National Assembly must also recommend the fixed term of appointment, and that can't exceed more than 7 years, and then also who would be the chairperson and deputy chairperson. So when we deliberate at the very end, those are things that we would need to make recommendations around. The other thing is, and Mr. Swart mentioned it, is that the present commissioners are eligible for reappointment. Obviously have to apply and go to the same process. I have prepared a few slides around the essential qualifications.
Sorry, did you say the present commissioners are eligible but they don't need to apply?
No, they do. I have prepared a few slides around essential qualifications, and I don't know whether you need me to go through that. No, fine. And then, the one thing we talk about when we get to the shortlisting process is when we actually get to interviews, the ad hoc committee asked the candidates to prepare a presentation. That was quite, I thought it was quite useful, so perhaps the members can think about it. There's no need to make decision, but it might be useful to ask them to have a short presentation around who they are and why they think that they would be the right person for the position. So it's a nice way of introducing, and it covers a lot of ground in a short space of time. Sorry, Mr. Impawan. Just with regard to the areas of speciality, there's nothing in the law that requires that commissioners have particular focus areas. So they've already organized it amongst themselves. And the researchers, and I'll prepare a proper note on this, but I did a quick internet search, and we have the following areas: disability and older persons, Children's rights and basic education. Sorry. Human rights and law in law enforcement and the prevention of torture. Migration and equality. Migration and equality. And then access to justice and housing, and that's been done by Advocate Amemia. So that's already been filled, that area. And then just to remind you that the chairperson, Advocate Mushwane, is also the chair of the International Coordinating Committee on National Human Rights Institutions. So I think a lot of his work is focused towards that. No, it's just that there is an international focus as well.
So it's crossing off the list.
No, we don't want any discrimination. So everybody
who has applied, let them go through the same process, whether we know more or less about them, so that the principle of fairness can be upheld. I'll start at the back, Honorable Hall, Honorable Bungan, Honorable Majas.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. The way I understand the questionnaire in the case of the public protector was only given to those shortlisted. But given the fact that we will have to take into account who want to or can serve as full-time and part-time counselors, I would hope that we maybe do the questionnaire to all 80, or at least get that information from everybody before we do the shortlisting. Thank you.
I'll come back to Honorable.
Yes, I just wanted the time frames for the people that when are they going to call us to go to the radio stations or whatever the public or the radio, whatever, so that we have a time frame. We know that at least they start negotiating if the address starts from today. We need to have some idea.
Let me just say that they still have to negotiate the time slots, but can we commit ourselves to say between today and the 25th, these matters take priority. Between today, 22nd of September, and the 25th of October, this matter takes priority. And then also, there's a proposal that only the shortlisted persons must get the questionnaire. Do we all agree with that?
Yes.
Mrs. Silk?
I may be incorrect. I think that the questionnaire has already been developed, and Benani unfortunately is not here, Mr. Moran is not here, but I think it may have already been distributed to everybody.
Let me just clarify my comment. I didn't suggest that only the shortlisted ones get it. What I suggested that it must include an indication as to whether they are prepared to serve full-time or part-time, and if we're only going to do it for those shortlisted, that we get that information from all applicants before the shortlisting process.
You see, the questionnaire is a tool that must help even in the pre-screening, even in the shortlisting. So there's no harm if it is released to everybody. Can we go that route? I think Mr. Horn, Honorable Horn, has also clarified that he was not even suggesting that. So it's in order that the questionnaire is gone. Any other comment?
No, Chairperson, I wanted to, when you look at areas of speciality, I didn't know that the questionnaire was gone already, but with what you are presenting, to say that you'll be looking at access to justice and housing, and I'm thinking that what their approach is to actually develop socioeconomic rights report annually, And I'm looking at other rights, like education is there with children, but there's no health, water and sanitation. And I was just thinking that these are some of the things that could be added onto the questionnaire so that you try to find their strengths around these rights.
No, I think you should say that the questionnaire that left is an unauthorized questionnaire, because this committee has a collective responsibility to make sure that every step that we take is taken by us collectively. So if there are things in the questionnaire that leaves something to be desired, and I think it has to be fixed, so it's good that you are saying that on record so that we can revise it and reissue it. Christine, are you happy with that?
Yes.
Yeah, speak.
Can I just add, Ms. Pilanumajak is correct. I mean, the Human Rights Commission Act just requires that the commission have a record of commitment to the promotion of human rights and a culture of human rights and the person with applicable knowledge and experience. And if you look at the constitutional mandate of the commission, it does involve looking at things like water and sanitation. So I think the focus areas that I mentioned, that is the present commissioner's internal division of labor focus areas that they've decided on. So we're not confined to those areas.
We can be confined because we have to be informed what is happening in society itself. We have been in this institution from 1994, and the experience that we have gathered is very important. So I'm happy that you picked that up, Christine, and that's the way to go. Honorable members, are we all happy? And that means that we have now a process in place, and all members of society, from the illiterate to the most literate, to organized and well-resourced NGOs, and everybody is welcome. We don't want to have any private dealings with anybody. We have a public process, and we want everybody to participate in the public process that is transparent, so that we can all take responsibility for the outcome of the process. And thank you very much for all your inputs, and this part of the meeting is concluded. Let's have comfort break, so that those who have to leave are not evicted but leave voluntarily.
Yeah. Huh?
Or eerder eerbare leden, maar ons moet nu beginnen. Ladies, honorable members, Mr. Budget, Bassett, I wanted to see if we are all awake. Now, I'm sure that we are all awake. We are here to get responses from Mr. Bassett and Mr. Dupree on the Protectors Disclosures Amendment Bill. And we have challenges of flights on the part of some members. And I'm sure that, as usual, you will be pointed and in your responses so that we finish on time to allow others to go. Honorable
Chair, just before we start, there was further documentation that we still need to get. I understand that Committee Clerk is trying to get it for us from the Open Democracy Centre. Remember, we asked them for more submissions, and I don't know how relevant it will be when we get to discussing with the department. So we do need it. I'm sure we can continue.
No, the documents are here. There will be. We value those documents. That's why we ask for them. So they will be tabled here. Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Chair, just in terms of time, it would be what time are we looking at so that we can tailor our responses?
See, we cannot prescribe the time because it will do injustice to you and to the people that we represent. We are just appealing to you to say, as usual, be pointed.
Thank you, Chair. A document has been circulated, and I trust honourable members have got a copy. I want to say before I hand over to Mr. Dupriya, who will be taking us through the responses, that there were late-night discussions last night, so there are one or two areas where we might deviate from our responses that are in this document, but we will highlight that when we get to it. If I may hand over to Mr. Dupriya, thank you.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, we have the summary. We have submitted the summary to the Portfolio Committee. The summary is divided into two tables. Table 1 reflects the recommendations or comments of a general nature, and then Table 2 focuses on the comments that were actually provided to the committee with respect to the different clauses of the bill. Now, I think it might be useful for the committee to note that most, in the majority, and in all the cases of the commentators who made submissions to the committee, they supported the bill. So what I would like to do is, in order for us to save a lot of time, I'm going to not take you through the document itself now, but I'm going to highlight to you the support that was expressed to the bill, and then we can go through the document itself compared to the bill. So, Mr. Chair, the Banking Association of South Africa, BASA, supports the bill. The Cape Bar Parliamentary Committee, the proposed amendments insofar as workers are concerned, provides adequate plea for workers who make protected disclosures. They support. The Commission for Gender Equality supports the bill, supports the extension and the ambit of the Act to include independent contractors and persons who have worked for an employer. The Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, welcomes and supports the bill, especially the extension of the ambit to include workers and temporary employment services, the synchronization of the term unfair discrimination in the Act with other legislation dealing with unfair discrimination, the proposed inclusion of being threatened or subject to civil claims for making disclosures, the joint liability of the employer and the client, the introduction of the provision providing workers with the right to seek relief from any court. They also support the duty to inform and the exclusion of civil and criminal liability. Corruption Watch welcomes the proposed extension of the ambit of the Act. The Open Democracy Advice Centre, ODAC, the extension of protection to workers and those in temporary employment services is absolutely necessary. Chair, then also the Commission on Gender Equality supports the reference to the Employment Equity Act in the definition of disclosure to the extent that any discrimination on the basis of gender is then forms part of the ambit of the Act. The Commission of Gender Equality then once again supports the proposed new section dealing with joint liability, which will ensure that employers and contractors do not escape liability by shifting the blame in the event of contraventions. ODAC commence the expansion of the remedies provided for in the proposed new subsection 1B of the proposed new clause to be inserted in the bill. Chair, so in short, that is now, and ODAC also then supported the new provision dealing with the exclusion of civil and criminal liability. So, Chair, just to highlight that the committee was given an all-round indication by the commentators that they did support the bill. However, we could now possibly then just focus on those specific comments where they have made recommendations or possibly even objections to some of the provisions. Now, on the very first page, then on table one, with regard to the Banking Association of South Africa, they accepted that the bill introduces the concept of ex-employee and ex-worker, and they argue it's indefinite in time, which may have unintended consequences as evidence, memory, persons, etc., change over time. They recommend that a specific period, for example 3 years, be introduced to the application of ex-employers and ex-workers. The department does not support the proposal, Mr. Chair, and it's not clear why the limitation itself should only apply in respect of ex-employees or workers. A restriction of this nature may have unintended consequences of placing a restriction on the provisions of other legislation, for example, Section 18 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which deals with the prescription of the right to institute prosecutions. More importantly, Mr. Chair, the Department is of the view that the proposed restriction is not in the interest of disclosing improprieties in the workplace. And we feel that an employer or worker should not be prevented from making a disclosure merely because there may be a possibility that the matter cannot be investigated due to the lack of evidence. Mr. Chair, you will find that at the back of the document, I have included two pages, annexures A to D, E, and where we refer to legislation, we have just quoted the relevant provisions for the ease of convenience for the committee. Mr. Chair, I will then go to the next page where Corruption Watch recommends that sanctions should be included in the Act in respect of employers who do not comply with the provisions of the Act. Personal liability should be considered according to them where employers do not comply with the provisions of the Act. Mr. Chair, we have our response there, but I think we would like to emphasize then in that response to the second last sentence of that response. I think that is the crux of the matter for us, is that the purpose of an offense or any other section is merely to punish the employer without any reference to the personal circumstances of the employee. So it's extremely difficult to see what value the proposal will add to the bill itself. On the next page, Open Democracy Advice Center, they advised or recommended that the Section 10 guide does not provide enough practical advice to employers on how the Act can implement it. The guide should be revised. Mr. Chair, our response is simply that we do not dispute that. The guide that has been issued in terms of the Act will have to be amended as a result of the Act being amended. So the proposal will then, of course, receive the necessary attention during that process. ODAC also recommended that financial incentives should be introduced. That is where persons who disclose corruption and there's an eventual conviction and possibly penalty imposed, that a person then gets a percentage of that as a reward for coming forward and assisting the state to prosecute successfully. The ODAC quoted Section 34B of the National Environmental Management Act, which provides for the reward to an informant. We have indicated to the committee that Section 61 of the Marine Living Resources Act, Section 60 of the National Forest Act, And then, of course, Section 34 of NEMA contained reward provisions. We would like to point out to the committee that these acts are restricted in their application to environmental matters. The ambit of the PDA, on the other hand, is much larger, and the application of the act extends to each and every employer and employee relationship. The inclusion of a reward system in the Protected Disclosures Act may give rise to certain negative consequences, Mr. Chair. It may leave institutions vulnerable to information peddling, especially with regard to sensitive information. There may also be a shift in the emphasis from disclosures being made in the public interest to disclosures that are made solely for purposes of financial gain. The provisions of the Act are based, among others, on the principle that every employer and employee has a responsibility to disclose criminal and every other irregular conduct in the workplace. The objects of the Act are therefore in line with the National Development Plan, which, among others, with regard to fighting corruption, calls for public service to maintain a high standard of professional ethics. The concern is that the introduction of a reward system will bring about a shift in emphasis in the Act from disclosure of improprieties in the public good to disclosures for purposes of financial gain. The disclosure of information in public interest with a view to remedying improprieties remain one of the cornerstones of the Act. This fundamental principle should be retained in our legislation with a view to building integrity, which is an essential component of achieving good governance as confirmed in the National Development Plan. The paragraph following the one that I have just quoted to you, Chair, at this stage, and I must admit to my own detriment, I don't think that paragraph is relevant, so with your permission, I would like to strike that paragraph. But we would like to emphasize that it's therefore necessary to create a balance between disclosures which are bona fide and those that are not. In view of the aforementioned, the department does not support the introduction of financial incentives.
Chair, may I also just come in here, please? The National Environmental Management Act of 1998, to which Mr. Dupree has referred, I think it's important also for committee members just to realize that it goes further than that, Section 34B. Section 34B2 limits, has a limitation on rewards. It says a person in the service of an organ of a state, of state, or engaged in the implementation of this act or specific environmental management act is not entitled to such award. So it excludes public servants from receiving any type of reward, I think, for good reason.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Bassett, I would like to make a particular disclosure to you. Now, I think Mr. Bassett stole the words from my mouth, because that is that is exactly what I wanted to point out to you, Chair, at this stage, is not only the National Environmental Management Act, but also the others. They exclude civil servants, and this is an extremely important point that the committee will have to take into consideration. We must remember that the ambit of the Protected Disclosures Act not only covers civil servants, but applies to both public and private sectors. Still with the comments by, with general comments by ODAC, Mr. Chair, and the reason why the next one, why I've placed it in Table 1 is that our response is that we're going to deal with that outside of the Act itself, but they have recommended that the Section 8 bodies, namely the Public Protector and Auditor General, exclude other bodies that are capable of doing something about allegations. They recommend that, among others, the South African Human Rights Commission, the Commission on Gender Equality, the Electoral Commission, and the Speaker of the National Assembly and the Commissioner of SAPS be included in Section 8 of the Act. Now, our response, Mr. Chair, is that, and when we have approached our minister with our draft amendment bill, we have advised the minister of the need that has been expressed to extend the Section 8 bodies to include other bodies. But we have advised the minister that we are concerned that that list may become very long. That is the first factor to take into consideration. The second factor to take into consideration is that there might be a need to describe the jurisdiction of those bodies. In light thereof, we have recommended to our minister that, generally speaking, after the enactment of this amendment bill, we will approach the minister for consent to consult widely, not only once again with public sector bodies, but private sector bodies as well, in order to identify those bodies who would be able to be included in Section 8. First of all, to consult with them and to get their agreement to be included, but more importantly then to determine precisely what the jurisdiction is in order to include them in the regulations to the Act. Of course, Mr. Chair, the advantage of regulations is usually that they can be amended fairly quicker than legislation, so that if there is a need to include additional bodies, that can be made. But I am just quickly going to hand over to Mr. Bassett, Mr. Chair, with your permission.
Thank you, Chair. As I said, there were late-night discussions last night, and we would like to suggest that the committee consider possibly including at this stage three Chapter 9 institutions: the Commission on Gender Equality, the Human Rights Commission, and the Promotion and Protection of Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Communities. Those three commissions, they already have investigative powers in terms of their founding legislation. So that is something we put forward for the committee's consideration. Yes, as Mr. Dupria says, of course, we will have to consult with these bodies. That would be our recommendation to this committee, that they don't be included in the legislation without their knowledge and being able to gear up for such thing. If the committee would like us to, we as a department could approach these three important bodies and find out what their views are and report back on that particular aspect. Thank you.
Yes, proceed.
No, I just want the names again. Human Rights Commission?
Human Rights Commission, Gender Commission, and then the
Commission
for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Communities.
No, I think we should allow you to have bilaterals with them and then come back to us.
I'm not nearly halfway, Mr. Chair. Yes, Chair, we are actually in the process at the moment. One of the general comments that they have also made was with regard to confidentiality. They indicated to the committee that the Act contains no express obligation to protect a person's identity. Confidentiality being preserved between the two parties as a proactive obligation mitigates against the detriments the Act seeks to avoid. They recommend that a breach of confidentiality should be included in the definition of occupational detriment. The response at this stage, Mr. Chair, is that the disclosure of the identity of a whistleblower is not only information which could cause harm and is in need of protection. A person identified by a whistleblower also deserves protection from malicious or bona fide but wrongful disclosures. There is a need to treat all information, including the subsequent investigation relating to disclosure of improprieties, confidential. Information relating to a protected disclosure should only be discussed or disclosed to a person who has a legitimate right to such information, or for the purposes of investigating the disclosure in order to compile a report or convey a recommendation in connection with the disclosure. the introduction of a blanket prohibition against revealing the identity of a whistleblower is not conducive to the proper investigation of such disclosure. What we would like to point out, and which I have neglected to write or put in this summary, Chair, is that we feel at this stage that this matter is something that could possibly more appropriately be dealt with in the guidelines to be issued under the Act, in order to provide general guidelines to employers to ensure that where it's absolutely necessary, the confidentiality of the identity of the person who made the protected disclosure is then protected. And so far as the Public Service Commission is concerned, they recommend that employers who subject employees to occupational detriment should be subject to criminal liability. This is a repetition of previous comments by another commentator, so we just refer you to the relevant paragraph, as well as the second comment, and that is that the PDA should be amended to ensure that the identity of persons who make disclosures should remain confidential. We just refer you to our response then on the ODAC proposal. They have also, the Public Service Commission has also recommended that a public service servant disclosure protection tribunal should be created with different powers, among others, to impose sanctions where employees are subjected to occupational detriment and even reinstate suspended officials or award compensation for financial loss. We argue that the proposal does not take note of the ambit of the Act, namely being applicable to both public and private sectors. In the first instance, the proposed extension of the remedial action that is available to persons who make protected disclosures and the remedies that are available in terms of the existing labor law are sufficient to address those cases of occupational detriment that employees may be subjected to as a result of having made protected disclosures. They've also recommended that employers should be obliged to implement internal procedures which could be used by employees to make disclosures. We merely indicate to you that that is precisely what our bill does. It's one of the proposed amendments, Chair. And they have also recommended that employees who make false disclosures should be subjected to criminal sanction. And that is, of course, the proposed new Section 9B. They have also indicated that the Witness Protection Act should be amended to provide for physical security of persons who make disclosures and investigators who investigate improprieties. The Department does not support the proposal. It should be noted that the wide range of disclosures that are catered for in terms of the Act, anything from disclosures relating to cases of discrimination to the most serious offences. So the PDA aims to protect an employee or worker from being subjected to occupational detriment. The Act therefore focuses on an employee or worker and his or her working environment. The Witness Protection Act already provides for the persons to be placed under protection in cases of serious offences. They have also recommended that any interference with or intimidation of investigators should be subject to criminal sanction. Our response is that the ambit of the Act is limited to employees and workers and therefore only deals with the protection of employees and workers from being subjected to occupational detriment. Interference with the work of investigators is a matter which is usually dealt with in legislation dealing with the powers, functions and duties of different types of investigators. And then they've also indicated that the Section 8 bodies should be extended to include those that have been mentioned by the South African Law Reform in its report, including the Public Service Commission. We have already indicated what the position there is at this stage, Mr. Chair. So we will then get back to the committee on those three proposed new commissions to be included. We are now at the bottom of, at the bottom of page 6, but we are starting now with table 2 of the summary, Mr. Chair. The Banking Association of South Africa indicated that the term temporary employment service should not be repeated in the definition itself, and they've made a recommendation how to address that. Mr. Chair, this is a technical comment, and although the proposal is sound on a technical level, we have indicated to you that there is an existing definition in the Labour Relations Act of temporary employment service, and although we might have wanted to define it differently, we feel it is more appropriate for purpose check.
Sorry, I just wanted to check. So, in terms of the Section 8 bodies that you, the list of people that you're going to, bodies that you're going to consult with, are you including the PSC as well? Because you didn't mention. No.
That's something we could also look at if the chair and the committee agrees.
That's Public Service Commission and SAPS. We need to know why they're not included in that section as well. But that's when we have discussion.
Did you hear what is being said, this exchange? Can you just respond so that people hear what you are saying?
I'm sorry, Chair, we're not engaging now, but I just thought if we are going to consider Public Service Commission, we would need to look at why SAPS is not included as well. They've got investigative capacity as well. So that's open for another discussion. I don't know if you want to engage that now, but maybe...
No, I think just note that and see how you are going to deal with the matter and come back to us at some later stage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Commission on Gender Equality recommends that the definition of occupational detriment should include an additional detriment, namely the imposition of any unfair restraint of trade on an employee or former employee, to be included in that definition. Our response is that the definition concerned is wide enough to include the imposition of unfair restraint of trade, to the extent that the definition concerned provides, among others, that an occupational detriment manifests where a person is adversely affected in the respect of his or her employment, profession, or office, including employment opportunities and work security as a result of having made a protected disclosure. The proposal is therefore not supported. It is submitted that the definition, which is an open-ended one, cater for all instances where a person is subject to any form of detriment as a result of having made the protected disclosure. Then, and this is Mr. Chair, and you must please excuse me, this is the only place in our summary where we have started responding to the comment by ODAC with regard to the definition of occupational detriment. But you will see in our response, we have inserted question marks. We did not really understand to the fullest extent what they were trying to convey to the committee. I have written or sent an email to them for purposes of clarity. I have received that email. With your permission, I would like this one to stand over, Mr. Chair. For
Mrs. Tilly, can you hear properly where you are?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I thought if you can, you can get near. I can see that... you are struggling to.
Sorry, thank you. Would you like me to speak to
No,
you?
I just meant that it will be closing up for years.
Thank you.
So that if there's something you want to speak to,
proceed.
Thank you, Chief. The South African Reserve Bank, with reference to the employer, indicated that it does not make provision for the situation where a person works for an affiliate to a holding company and then makes a protected disclosure to the affiliate about the holding company and then being subjected to an occupational detriment. So they have recommended that a reference then should be included in the definition of employer to affiliates. But this proposal is not supported. And the reason for that is that it's not clear whether a disclosure to a subsidiary in respect of a holding company will serve any useful purpose. It is doubted whether a subsidiary will be able to address an impropriety that takes place in a holding company. An employee or worker will under these circumstances probably have to decide between a disclosure in terms of Section 8 of the Act or then a disclosure in terms of Section 9 of the Act, which is general protected disclosures. General protected disclosures, Mr. Chair, one should just possibly pause for 2 seconds and just indicate to you that a worker or an employee is free to make a disclosure to any institution, any person under Section 9 of the Act, including, for example, the South African Police Services. They have made a technical recommendation as well for the inclusion of the words or received in the definition of employee. We support that and we will recommend to the committee that an appropriate amendment be prepared in that regard. Corruption Watch is concerned that individuals who occupy positions of authority and governance are not regarded as being in employment relationship. You will recall, Mr. Chair, that I've used the example of members of school governing bodies and members of boards who are responsible for trusts, companies and voluntary associations, and they argue that they should be included within the definition of the employment relationship for purposes of the Act. Our response is that persons who occupy positions of authority and governance assist in carrying on or conducting the business of an employer. Now, this phrase is already included in the definition of employer, and it is submitted that those, that the persons who, for example, serve on school boards are then already included within the ambit of the Act. I think, Mr. Chair, you will recall that you have given the department the opportunity when Corruption Watch addressed the committee to ask or raise a question, and this was exactly the question that we have raised, and if I remember correctly, the gentleman of Corruption Watch then agreed with us that the individuals or the example that they have used could then be regarded as persons who assist in carrying on or conducting the business of an employer. They've also indicated that the definition of occupational detriment being subjected to any civil claim. The restriction to disclosures of criminal offence, according to them, is too narrow. Employees and workers should be protected when making disclosures about procurement irregularities, breach of legal obligations, and other information referred to in the definition of protected disclosure. We would like to point out to the committee that any breach of confidentiality is a serious matter. The disclosure of a criminal offence is of a serious enough nature to justify the alleged breach of confidentiality. The definition of occupational detriment, according to them, should include a prohibition on initiating criminal proceedings against employees and workers. And they argue that restriction to civil liability reduces the protection offered to employees or workers. Our response is, Mr. Chair, that the definition of occupational detriment is once again wide enough to include initiating criminal proceedings against employees or workers, to the extent that the provision provides for, among others, that an occupational detriment is where a person is adversely affected in respect of his or her employment, etc. But the most important thing I think that we would like to point out to the committee is initiating criminal proceedings is something that will not happen, to the extent that it's unlikely that an employer will succeed in initiating criminal proceedings against an employee to the point where a prosecution is instituted against that employee, because it's only the national prosecuting authority then that decides whether a prosecution should be instituted or not. The definition of protected disclosure, they argue that employees or workers may be subjected to an occupational detriment for breaching legislative prohibitions on disclosing information. Most legislative prohibitions create offences which will exclude employees and workers from the Act. For example, Section 22 of the Financial Services Board Act provides limited circumstances under which information that has been obtained in the performance of any power or function under that Act may be utilized or disclosed. And they've also referred us to Section 27 of the Financial Services Board. Mr. Chair, our response is that the examples they have used do not fall within the ambit of the Act. The restrictions in other legislation with regard to the disclosure of information relate to the powers that are exercised by employees. These powers generally relate to investigations conducted by statutory bodies. And we argue that it stands to reason that information obtained during an investigation falls in a different category than knowledge of any impropriety in an employee's own working environment. They have also indicated that in deciding the reasonableness of a general protected disclosure in terms of Section 9.3, consideration may be had to whether a disclosure was made in breach of a duty of confidentiality of the employer towards any other person. They argue that the provision is at odds with the proposed amendment of the definition of occupational detriment, which aims to protect employees and workers who breach confidentiality agreements when making protected disclosures. Our response is that the proposed amendment of the definition of occupational detriment is limited to those instances where a disclosure of a criminal offence has taken place. The requirement is not at odds with the provisions of Section 9.3 of the Act. The disclosure of an offence in breach of confidentiality agreement is only one of a number of factors that a court has to take into consideration on a case-by-case basis in order to determine the reasonableness of the disclosure itself. With regard to the new proposed provisions of joint liability and then the duty to inform the employee, we have already indicated that the Commission of Gender Equality supports the proposed new 3A. With regard to the proposed new 3B, and we've included the comments by the Auditor General, Mr. Chair, because it was submitted to the committee and we have summarized it. But you will note that the comments was actually dated 2014, for July 2014, it was addressed to me in my capacity as an official of the department. That is the reason, or the reason for that is that we have indicated to the committee that we've also conducted a round of consultation on the bill itself. But the advantage with regard to their comments is that we indicate that we have addressed their concerns. So it will give the committee some useful background when we start looking at the other comments with regard to the proposed new B. The South African Reserve Bank has made technical proposals for the amendment of subsection 4. We agree with that, Mr. Chair. We feel that it's an improvement of the wording of that subclause. We will recommend to the committee that it will be that the provision should be amended accordingly. And then Business Banking Association of South Africa, they've indicated that the terms employee and worker include ex-employees and ex-workers, which may sometimes be difficult to track down. They recommend that the phrase practicable and reasonable steps to be taken to inform the employee or worker should then be inserted in that requirement. The department is not opposed to the proposed amendment because there are certainly instances where it might be difficult to track those people down. So it's a question of trying to find a balance between the requirement and relaxation of the requirement itself. And then with regard to the term disclosure, which includes criminal offences, the duty to revert to an employee places an employer in a difficult position to determine when and to what extent such information should be disclosed relating to the reasons why a matter is not being investigated. And the example that they use is if banks are involved in sting operations or providing feedback regarding the outcome of an investigation without breaching other pieces of legislation. We have indicated that these concerns have been noted. The department is not opposed to including a caveat in the provision to avoid prejudice to the maintenance of the law insofar as the prevention, detection and investigation of offences are concerned. Still with this provision, ODAC recommended that the 21-day period be reduced to 14 days. The department submits that 21 days is a reasonable period. It may be that an employee may make a protected disclosure on day one, but the disclosure may only come to the attention of an employer a few days later. It's only fair towards an employer to provide him or her with a reasonable period in order to decide what to do. They have also expressed their concerns or their concern with regard to the provisions of the proposed new subsection 3 of the section 3B. They argue that it renders the 21-day periods null and void, actually, because they say that an employer can avoid making a decision for an extended period of 6 months with no need for justification. And they recommend reducing the 6 months to 3 months. Our response, Mr. Chair, is that the requirement is that an employer must decide as soon as reasonably possible what to do. In cases where a disclosure reveals information of a clear impropriety in the workplace, a shorter period based upon the facts of the case will apply. But certain disclosures may involve information that require further preliminary investigations before an employer will be in a position to make an informed decision regarding the way forward. In this regard, the department submits that the period of 6 months provided for is reasonable. They have also indicated or recommended that the notice in terms of the proposed new subsection 4 should be in writing. The department does not support the proposal. Some employers allow for anonymous disclosures to be made, and the requirement of notifying the employee or worker concerned in writing will then defeat the purpose of such disclosures. Corruption Watch indicated with regard to the proposed new subsection 3B2 that it should be amended to require detailed reasons to be provided to an employee or worker. This is essential to hold the employer accountable for an arbitrary decision and to ensure that the employee or worker is able to interrogate whether the employer has applied his or her mind. The procedures, according to the department, provided for by the Act are conducive to disclosures being made to an employer. Employers who do not act upon disclosures that have been made by their employees or workers do so at their own peril, Mr. Chair. This is so because an employer or worker is at liberty to make the same disclosure to another body or institution. However, the proposal for reasons to be provided is, according to the department, sound, and the department would most probably then, during the deliberations of the committee, recommend that a requirement of adequate reasons be included in the provision. Corruption Watch have also argued that the duty to inform should extend to Section 9 situations. Those are the general protected disclosures. And they argue that employers should report on steps taken in relation to general protected disclosures. Our response is merely to say that in many instances, general protected disclosures will be made without the employer knowing the identity of the employee or worker concerned. It will therefore not serve any useful purpose to introduce such a requirement. The General Counsel of the Bar pointed out that persons who make disclosures can apply to review a government department's decision taken in accordance with the proposed Section 3B sub 3. They say that provision should be made to prevent private entities from properly investigating disclosures made to it by providing for its decision to be reviewed or appealed against if and when necessary. The department does not support the proposed amendment because it stands to reason that if an employee or worker in the private sector has made a disclosure to his or her employer and the employer does nothing about the disclosure, that employee or worker is free to make a wider disclosure in accordance with the provisions of the Act. With regard to Clause 5 of the Bill, which is the proposed amendments to Section 4, the Commission on Gender Equality recommends that a provision should be inserted which reads, where the cause of action relates to an unfair dismissal, then the matter may be treated as one. Those are remedies that can be exercised in the Labour Court. The Department does not support this proposal. The proposed extension of remedies that will be available to employees and workers, which are now provided for in the Bill, does not justify preferential treatment in terms of labour law in comparison to other employees or workers. Just to point out again, Mr. Chair, that ODAC supported the expansion of the remedies. Then on the next page, the South African Reserve Bank has once again made a technical proposal to the amendment of one of our provisions in Section 4. It's a sound recommendation and it is supported. I feel it adds value to the provision itself. Then Kusatu has objected to replacing the word must in Section 4.2a with the word may. They argue that the word may weaken the rights and protection of workers. But this is a consequential amendment precisely because of the fact that the remedies of workers and employees are now being extended, Mr. Chair. So it's not a question of you only have remedies in terms of the labour law now. You may approach any court for remedial action. So that is why we had to include or replace the word must with may in order to provide the worker with a leeway to decide which way to go. And then Kusatu also recommended that subsection 4 of the Act should be deleted. It is strongly opposed against a worker's deterioration in terms of conditions. They argue that unscrupulous employers might take advantage of this situation to the detriment of workers. And the department would like to point out to the committee that this measure was included for the protection of employees in big organizations who could be transferred to other sections of the organization concerned. Some employees or workers will be willing to retain employment at less favorable employment in order to avoid being victimized further. Then with regard to the proposed amendment of Section 6, the Commission on Gender Equality recommended that a provision should be included to the extent that every employer must keep a record of all disclosures made by an employee or worker, including what steps were taken in any disclosure, which will include steps to protect an employee or a worker. The department does not support the proposal, Mr. Chair, because the requirement will detract from the proper aim of a disclosure, namely to report improprieties in the workplace with the objective of ensuring that the employer acts upon information that has been disclosed. And then ODAC has made also, like the South African Reserve Bank did with regard to other provisions, they have made, this is not a technical amendment. They recommend that irrespective of the proposed new subsection 2A, that subsection 1A should be amended to avoid the situation that an employee or worker finds himself or self in a gap between subsection 1A and B. Our response here is merely to indicate that the proposal is supported, Mr. Chair. Clause 7, the proposed amendment of Section 7 of the Act. The Commission on Gender Equality recommends an amendment to the extent that any disclosure made in good faith to a member of Cabinet, which is the existing part of that section, and then they would like to include any member or committee of the National Assembly regarding any constitutional institution, and then so that is the emphasis that they would like to include. Our response, or the department's response, is that the proposed amendment does not fit into the ambit of Section 7 of the Act. Section 7 only relates to disclosures that may be made to members of the executive where employees or workers work for institutions that are accountable to members of the executive. It will serve a better purpose to include a member or a committee of the National Assembly in the regulations to be promulgated in terms of Section 8 of the Act. We also indicate that it's not clear why the proposal is limited to the National Assembly and does not include a reference to the National Council of Provinces. And we would like to indicate that these are all matters that we will have to address during that larger consultation process, Mr. Chair. And then we would like to point out as well that it should be kept in mind that disclosures to members of the National Assembly are not prohibited. Those disclosures are made in terms of Section 9 of the Act. Then Clause 10, which aims to introduce 9A, which deals with the civil and criminal liability exclusion, and then also the disclosure of false information. The South African Reserve Bank, Mr. Chair, has once again made a technical proposal. I'm not going to bore the committee with the detail now. We have noted it for your in the summary. We support their proposal. ODAC supports the proposed new provision, and then they've indicated that the intention of the provision is to protect persons who disclose improprieties. The requirement that the provisions of the new provision only apply in respect of a disclosure of an offence may, according to them, be unintentionally restricting. They recommend that the wording similar to the Promotion of Access to Information Act be used. Now, I'm not going to quote the section, it is there. The department's response is that we do not support the granting of a blanket immunity from all categories of protected disclosures. A person may, for example, be subject to a secrecy clause or a duty to confidentiality, and by making a disclosure may disclose information which may be highly sensitive. The disclosure of certain information may compromise the security of the country or be detrimental to the livelihood of an employer. The substance of the disclosure must be of such a nature that it justifies breaching, for example, the secrecy or confidentiality agreement, and being granted then in the process immunity from liability. The department is of the view that the immunity from liability should only be granted where a criminal offence has been committed. The ambit of the Protected Disclosures Act differs drastically from that of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. The proposed provision is then therefore too wide and extend beyond the disclosure of offences. Corruption Watch has indicated to the committee that the limitation to disclosures of criminal offences is a significant reduction in the protection of whistleblowers. They recommend that the protection should be extended to all aspects referred to in the definition of protected disclosure, and our response is to just refer you to the response in relation to ODAC's comments, which I have just read to you. Banking Association of South Africa, with regard to the disclosure of false information, I argue that civil remedies are available to address damage caused by a false disclosure, but processes are expensive and drawn out. They recommend that any damage to an entity or person should be taken into account by a court as an aggravating factor in sentencing. Although they then support this clause, we do not support the recommendation, Mr. Chair, to the extent that we indicate merely that courts are free to take any factors into consideration in mitigation or aggravation of sentences, including the proposed factors in the provision concerned might become a determining factor in persuading persons not to make disclosures. Corruption Watch argues that the sanction that disclosures that are made in bad faith do not qualify as protected disclosures already exist in terms of the Act. The introduction of an offence is unnecessary and may deter employees and workers from making disclosures. Now, the Department's response, Mr. Chair, is that the disclosure of deliberately or recklessly false information does not qualify as a protected disclosure in terms of the Act. That is true. The concern in this regard is that the principle is not expressly stipulated in the Act. The principle is captured in the good faith requirement, which is a prerequisite for any of the four procedures for a protected disclosure as referred to in sections 6 to 9 of the Act. If these four procedures have been introduced, stipulated in section 21C of the Act to ensure that an employee can, in a responsible manner, disclose information regarding improprieties by his or her employer. The Act therefore places a high premium on the responsible manner in which employees must disclose information regarding improprieties. However, the Act only deals with one consequence of a false disclosure, namely that such a disclosure does not qualify as a protected disclosure. It does not deal with the more serious consequences of a false disclosure. For example, the reputational damage that such a disclosure may cause to an innocent employee or employer. COSATU made recommendations with regard to this provision to provide stricter requirements to be complied with before criminal liability is then determined. The department supports this proposal, and we will, at a later stage, then recommend to the committee possibly including wording which deals with the requirement that a false disclosure has been made, for example, with the intention to cause harm. And then ODAC has indicated that the disclosure of false information does not constitute a protected disclosure in terms of the Act. Criminal provision will discourage people from raising concerns and will have a chilling effect on disclosures. The object of the Act, they argue, is to protect persons who make disclosures and not to protect information. The protection of information should be regulated by other acts designed for that purpose. We quote them there where they indicated that not only does this lead to significant confusion and overlap, but the provision is also directly mitigates against the Act's substantive purpose. The proposed provision, according to them, contradicts international best practice and the recommendations by the Law Reform Commission. Now, this is the last piece of comment that we have in our summary, Mr. Chair, and we have, in this regard, would like to repeat our response that we've given with regard to the comment that has been given by Corruption Watch. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, what we have in our possession is the document prepared by the Open Democracy, which is dated the 18th of August. Mm-hmm. I understand that a document dated 15 September has been circulated to members of the committee yesterday. Unfortunately, Chair, I haven't received the document, and I apologize for that. Although it would have been too late at this stage to include what I've said here in the summary, because we've already submitted the summary to the committee. But we are now in possession of the document, Chair. And with your permission, when the committee starts deliberating, we would then be able to, during that process, respond to the additional information.
You can also enter into bilaterals with them on that, so that when you come to the committee, and then you have factored in their proposals. As I was saying yesterday in the committee, you know, if we were a court, I would say that Mrs. Tilly and her organization are friends of the court, because they really make very positive contributions. And you see the documentation that they produce, teaching and learning about whistleblowing, life orientation grade 8, learning outcome 2, social development. So they're even contributing to the educational system. Whistleblowing manual, a guide for shop steward to the Protection Disclosures Act. And you know, booklet called Heroes Under Fire. This one was distributed, Code of Good Conduct. You see, they act like they are an institution established to support democracy. And that's what we want, because building this democracy is for all of us. And Ms. Tilly, we want you to convey our appreciation to your directors to say you are really friends of not only of this committee, but of Parliament and society, and we think you will serve as a very good role model for others, and we appreciate that. Okay, thanks.
Honourable members?
Is there anything that Honourable...
I'm not sure if you want to start engaging now on all the different issues, or whether we should hold it over until those further letters have been discussed, and there could be some bilateral discussions. So I've noticed that there are a number of members not here. So I'm in your hands, Chair, but it might be wiser to hold over deliberations until those final submissions have discussed. We know the areas of contention are pretty clear. But it's in your hands, Chair. If you want to open the discussions now already, it's up to you, Chair.
More in your hands, and I think you are very accommodative.
Maybe we should adjourn now to allow that discussion to take place, Chair.
Chair, we would be in agreement with that proposal. Thank you very much.
See, as you were presenting, we also reserved the right to interrupt you and clarity, but I could see that members are happy with what you are proposing. But this is not the last opportunity. When you come back, we can engage further.
Sorry, for record, we're not happy with all the presentations, most definitely. There are a number of issues which we differ from. We haven't engaged on that, but I think it's a helpful document. The department, it's a helpful document.
No, what I mean is that happiness or otherwise can only come after engagement.
Yes.
I mean, at the moment you are happy with their preparations and the presentation. Honourable Majake.
Thank you, Chairperson. I agree that maybe we should adjourn and then continue in future, but I'm interested in the argument around false disclosure. I think Open Society Foundation is saying that they're not supporting it. Can you look into it? Because also, just to exclude it completely, where there is unfairness on the other side, may not be justifiable. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, Chair. In conjunction with the Honourable Pilani Majake has just said, the department, if I understand it correctly, still feels that the impact of reputational damage is more or less what it in their minds turn on. But it in essence is also not something that we've been afforded the opportunity to have real examples of. So for us to consider criminalisation, I think just to use the words reputational damage, I think cannot suffice. I think it's too vague at this stage. So if the department comes back and are still in support of criminalisation, I think we need more. Thank you.
You say open democracy do not agree with what?
Because it's criminalizing for the school.
Okay, so I think that's one of the issues that will be debated when we engage. So I hope you'll be there. And if there's any additional thing you want to give us and communicate with everybody. But we don't want people who just agree with us. We want people who keep us on our toes and to think. So, yes.
Honorable members, this brings us to the end of this meeting, and thank you very much for your contributions. And I wish it was a holiday tomorrow. I will wish you a long weekend, but unfortunately, you have to work tomorrow.
Thank you.